resolution. John Ballantyne functions in the film as a mystery to be solved, and attempts at visual evocativeness regarding his character seem to get in the way of the narrative drive to unravel that mystery and to make it all fall neatly within the whodunit plot. In its representation of the male and female subject, Spellbound is an experimental work, awkward, overwrought, and just plain silly in places, yet it is tremendously rich in technical and conceptual possibilities. The film's central weakness, its inability to make the male subject the center of a psychological plot, would be readdressed in later films. After Spellbound, Hitchcock's plots increasingly turn upon the ways in which men are tantalized and tortured by a subjective experience associated with women. And as Paula Morantz Cohen and her terrific book Alfred Hitchcock, The Legacy of Victorianism, from the University Press of Kentucky. Thanks for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11. We'll be back next Friday. So until then, keep watching the screens.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO is serving up a series of scintillating sounds to help get you through the home stretch of winter. It's the thrilling Volume 2 of KBOO's annual programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills. Tune in for music marathons, public affairs series, special programming days, and more. Find all the great shows listed at kboo.fm/thrills. And please support awesome programming like this by making a donation to KBOO right now. Text KBOO to the number 44321 or mail a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and help us reach our $17,000 goal. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films throughout the month of February with a collection of films by African directors from over 16 nations.
Films will be screened at Cascade PCC, Hollywood Theater, and virtually. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
That's the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, showing Africa through African lenses, happening February 3rd until Saturday, March 4th, in celebration of Black History Month. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
Welcome to Out of the Streets of Portland, a new podcast focused on sharing the stories of people who are currently or formerly homeless in our community and helping to navigate the systems and services that the Joint Office of Homeless Services and its partners either have in place or are developing to help people move out of homelessness and back into stable, supportive housing. We're going to start each episode of the podcast with a segment called Busting a Myth. Today's myth is that the crisis of homelessness is more severe in Portland than anywhere else. The crisis of homelessness is a national crisis. Los Angeles County alone has 25% of the total unsheltered population in the U.S. Portland is 24th in the country for the rate of homelessness among cities with over 100,000 people, according to federal statistics. Even in the state of Oregon, the city of Portland accounts for just one quarter of the homeless population in the state. There are camps, especially since the pandemic began, in every major city in the U.S. That rising inflow into homelessness, driven by the market, perpetuates our community's crisis. In the past 2 years, even as thousands of people were able to move into housing, over 4,500 in the past year alone, more than 6,400 people accessed services for the first time in Multnomah County. and that inflow into homelessness tends to overshadow the profound successes shared by the thousands of people supported back into housing year after year by the Joint Office of Homeless Services and its provider partners. Recent research continues to build evidence for the link between affordability and homelessness. Yes, factors including substance use, behavioral health disorders, and enforcement are much discussed as visible realities on our streets. But across the country, nothing else correlates as closely to a community's rate of homelessness as much as housing costs. And in the Portland metro area, housing costs have been steadily increasing, jumping 13% in the last year alone. This next segment in Out of the Streets of Portland is definitions. In this short section, we define a term that's used in navigating through the homeless and housing system in our area. Today, we're going to define coordinated access. Now, what this refers to is a way of getting onto a by-name list. This is a list specifically for supportive housing. Coordinated access is not first come, first served. There are certain criteria to make sure people who are the most vulnerable, people with disabilities, or escaping from abusive situations or from marginalized communities are given a higher priority to get into housing sooner. Of course, the Joint Office and the local providers we work with want everyone who needs housing to get into housing. But with need outpacing the resources we have available, it's necessary to do this kind of triaging, as Celinda Mingo from the Urban League of Portland calls it. We're going to hear from Celinda later in this podcast, along with Katie Deneen from the Joint Office of Homeless Services, to explain more about coordinated access, how it works, how to get on the list, and which organizations are involved. This is part of the county's commitment to housing first, which means that our priority is housing people. Even while we're increasing the number of shelters and shelter beds, we have more shelter beds now than ever before, with many of them added in the last 3 years. The evidence-based practice of housing first just means that no matter where someone is at, our priority is to get them into housing first and wrap the needed supports around them. Many people find housing and support services right from the streets. Definitely look for the next episode of this podcast, where we'll do a deep dive into the evidence-based practice of housing first. In each episode of this podcast, we're going to share a story of someone who has experienced homelessness in the Portland metro area. Today, we're sharing the story of Dahl Crane, who's the head of the internship program at Cultivate Initiatives, funded by the Joint Office of Homeless Services through the Metro Supportive Housing Services measure.
I'm Dahl Crane, and I'm actually from Portland, Oregon. I was born and raised here. I raised my two sons here, and during raising my sons, I was a PE teacher for like 10 years. I started a boxing gym and turned my amateur program nonprofit. But unfortunately, I had domestic violence in my life from pretty much the get-go. And so every relationship that I was in just got worse and worse and worse. Thankfully, it didn't touch my children as much as it could have. They turned out to be great men in this society. And then after that, my parents had passed away right when my children were 18 and 19 and moving out of the home. So I kind of lost like all my family at once. And I decided I've never lived anywhere else. So I was gonna get my RV and travel. That created me into a homeless situation. Again, not blaming it on the relationship, but the relationship I was in at the time was the worst ever of all of them. Very bad. And it actually caused a lot more trauma than I realized. And so that was 4 years of homelessness by myself, right as it was getting very bad in the homeless communities, especially for a girl on your own. There was a lot of bad things happening. Not necessarily to me, it was kind of like I was able to stick up for and protect the younger girls. It was quite the experience. I actually did go travel a little bit. I went to Fargo, North Dakota and did the sugar beet harvest. They actually pay for your spot for an RV. You have to be self-contained for the month of October. And you only work 12 days in that whole month. But you just have to be there because you never know what 12 days it's going to be. And you just back up trucks and dump the loads, and that's about it. It was pretty easy work. Yeah, my first RV that I had broke down there. So I had to take the train back, and there I was. And I had an abusive boyfriend, so yeah, he took the money, and like they do. And craziness happened. But when I left him, I didn't have anything except my puppy at the time. I had just got her, and she was about 5 months old. And now it was just me and her.
Where'd you go?
Down 2,000 acres. I've been, like, again, I'm from Portland, and so I've been to the Sandy River pretty much my whole life. And it used to be Lewis and Clark. We used to camp there when I was a kid. And now it's a pretty amazing little community they have going on there. There's some rough guys there, rough people. It's kind of like the end. A lot of them don't leave the acres. A lot of them only venture as far as Walmart. It's right on that verge of Troutdale. It's right there by the bridge and the Thousand Acres Dog Park, which is kind of weird because I believe the homeless is who started calling it the Thousand Acres, and then now it's like been adopted by the community, and they have a support with the police down there and everything. They created this team of police officers called the Hope Team and actually go help them a lot, and they're amazing. They're awesome. They change the way a lot of the homeless feel about and deal with the police. They really do, because they come in non-threatening, even though they're in uniform or their cars. They really come in non-threatening, and they're not arresting anyone. They're not, you know, they're just trying to see what they can do to help. It's kind of amazing. One of my friends started working at Cultivate and kept telling me that I needed to come. And I've been here for about 8 months, and I'm now the intern coordinator. I've actually developed the whole program that we're using now for our orientation, for not the jobs they go do, those are still the same from when Cultivate started, but the way we handle the interns is a lot different. We give them an orientation, so we tell them what's going to happen during their week of working here, what they can expect. We set them up with our housing people, and we have placed, I think, 15, 16 interns into apartments or houses in the last 2 months. Amazing. And their rent is paid through the move in Multnomah for a year. Mine also, I got put into a house June 1st. And yeah, it's been a little overwhelming, to say the least. I'm making really good money. I'm living in a beautiful house, and I'm helping change people's lives that are on the streets. It's incredible. I never would have thought this is what it was going to be.
That was the story of Dahl, who's working with Cultivate Initiatives and managed to get into housing after years of living on the street. For more information on the internship program at Cultivate Initiatives, which provides short-term employment and job training to people experiencing homelessness, go to their website at cultivateinitiatives.org. For more information about the Joint Office and its Metro Supportive Housing Services investments, go to multco.us/JOHS. Coming up next, we're going to hear about how coordinated access for adults works and how it helps people get onto a list and then into permanent supportive housing as quickly as possible.
What our program does, we actually, it's entitled now the Culturally Specific Housing Assessment Team. And what we do is we go out into the BIPOC community, Black, Indigenous, people of color, assess folks. Once folks are assessed and they're placed on a list, which could be connected to the coordinated access through the Joint Office. And we really work hard to get people assessed and get people housed. Most of the folks we service are Latino, Hispanic, African-American, folks that have seemed to have kind of fallen off of the grid a little bit. So we go out and find those folks and get them connected to services, either services that are provided while we're searching for housing for them or while we're able to connect them. We have an outreach team that goes out and connect with folks to make sure that they have resources that they need until housing can be established for them. And we try and get folks connected with permanent supportive housing, which that's been a lot of the goal. We have a hotline that folks are able to call, and we're averaging 50 to 75 calls a week. And some of them people are just sometimes trying to get through the back door to get rental assistance. But for the most part, we try and make contact with those folks, do the assessment. That's one way of getting connected. Our outreach team also goes out into the community weekly, and they do what we call canvassing. And that's where they go to like the camps or the camp areas. And then they're able to get people, folks connected with resources, whether it be lunches, whether it be water, whether it be supplies, whatever they need, they go out as a team and get them the resources that they need. We don't do assessments out publicly because it is a private setting, but they're able to take down their name, number, and either myself or a couple other folks we have on our chat team will reach out to schedule a time to do the assessment. Some of our assessments are done over the phone. They're sometimes done virtually. And then sometimes we have folks that are actually available to meet with the participant wherever they are to do it more of a personal setting.
What is that assessment like for someone who is seeking services? How long does it take and what kind of questions are asked?
It can take anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour. It kind of depends on the person, and sometimes folks want to talk. And I try and engage where it's not like I'm questioning you and writing down your every. I try to make it more of a conversation to where they feel more comfortable to respond truthfully. Because I think a lot of times our culture thinks that we're asking questions to judge them. So I let them know up front, this is a no judgment zone. And we're literally trying to get as much information that we can to try and help get you housed. And when I develop that relationship, where I let them know to try to ease them, you know, because they're already going through enough trauma. And most of us are trauma informed, where we've gone through the CPR trauma informed training, so that we know how to, as we say, scan the room to see how to approach. The questions are about 50 questions, and they touch on your current living situation or your past living situation. They touch on medical, either conditions that you were diagnosed with, or you even may feel you have it. It gets into like mental health questions. So there's like a series of questions that we ask to determine, and it is on a number system. So depending on like the higher the score, the greater the chance, because the goal is to get folks scored higher than an 18 to be even considered for housing. Anybody lower than that, we sometimes have to find an alternative plan. And with Urban League having wraparound service, sometimes we're able to help folks get housed, because some folks come through, they're employed, they just can't seem to get to that next level. So then we're able to try and help provide services that way as well. Depending on what their barriers are, we also have access to getting folks referred over to the public defender's office. And that's a big tool that we use. The ones that tend to score kind of higher are the ones that have medical conditions, like severe medical conditions, that have severe mental health, that have severe abuse situations, ones that where they've been on the street for a longer time, they've had to encounter the police a certain times, you know, more than 10. They've had hospital where they've had to go to the hospital several times. Those are the folks that seem to me are scoring higher. So I would say it's a score system because there's so many people and that's the way of sifting through what we can serve and what we're not able to serve. But with the BIPOC, we try to get as many people served as we can, because there is a great, great need.
I mean, it sounds like it's kind of like triage in a hospital.
Yeah. Exactly. And you really have to sometimes it's a lot for me, like doing assessments, and I have to kind of step back and be like, whew, that was a lot. I'm glad I took trauma-informed training, because it's knowing for yourself how to take it all in, and then you have to know when to move urgently, and when there's times where they're okay, they just may need resources, sleeping bags, tents, gift cards, to get some food. We have so much different stuff available where our outreach team can go meet them and take them all the supplies that they need. There's a lot of folks that you run into that's just like want to give up. They just don't have no hope anymore. And having enough in you, in addition to your training, it helps you to kind of calm the, because it can get intense, you know, when they're having to recreate their trauma because they have to tell you details of stuff. And a couple times I've had to tell folks, let's take a break and then we can come back to it. But let's just have a conversation. Let's just me and you talk. So that training has really helped. Because I know before it used to, when people are saying stuff and you automatically have that sympathy and that empathy and you're like, oh, I know how you feel. So in the training, they train you, you know, you don't say you know how they feel because you don't know how people feel. But to let them know that their feelings are valid and this is where you are, but this is where I want to get you. And so when I come with that approach, it kind of softens and it's like, okay, because the thing is that they want to trust you. And you want to create that space so that they can. If that means you showing up, if you're supposed to call at 12, call it 11:58 so that they know you're there. And if they show up to do the work, I tell folks all the time, if you show up, then I'll show up with you. It's been working since we've been addressing it that way. We all work together, whether it be Cascadia Behavioral Health, whether it be TPI, or whether it be some of the shelters. Yeah, we all kind of work together to find them, keep them on the grid so that we can get them housed. A lot of it I still do myself. And I'm not in that role anymore, but it just came so natural to check in with folks. Like I'm constantly adding that to my calendar to check in because there's folks that I housed maybe a year and a half ago, you know, that were like the guy had been in his car for months, 8 to 9 months. And even though we housed him, He got into affordable housing and then mentally he just could not. The plan was to get him in and get him connected with a job. Like we have the workforce at the Urban League. We did his resume. I mean, I was up at like 7 a.m. meeting with him, trying to get him on Indeed. Like I literally worked with him for a year, but mentally he just could not get there, And so what I ended up doing was encouraging him to go back to go find his counselor, go back and get counseling. We know that you said to me, this is an issue. I didn't ask you if this was an issue. You said to me, I have this mental health issue. So I encouraged him to go back. He started going back to see his therapist. We got him on track. He got a part-time job. So now he actually got selected for Section 8. So he was able to move out of that unit and move into a unit of his own that he could pick that was a duplex. And so he's much happier. He's much content. But so it's tough. It's really tough unless we can encourage folks to identify that there's something that we need to address. It's a lot of case managing. When I connect with folks and I know that there's struggles there, you know, it's important to show up and be there even when it's not your job, because I don't like be like, that's not my job, I'm not doing that. My heart is for the people, and that's what I push for. It don't matter if it's 7 o'clock in the morning and I'm not on the clock yet, but I want to see you succeed.
If people want to find out more, or maybe if they are listening and qualify for the services that you're talking about and need help getting into housing, how can they contact you? How can they find out more?
They can call the main Urban League number, which is 503-280-2600, and ask to be connected to the chat line, which is our culturally specific housing assessment line. 211 also can direct them. They can say they're looking for the BIPOC chat, and they can get them connected that way as well.
Well, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Again, I've been speaking with Celinda Mingo, head of Collaborative Services Division at the Urban League and the culturally specific housing assessment team. Thank you, Celinda.
Thank you.
That was Celinda Mingo from the Urban League of Portland. Next, we go to Katie Dineen of the Joint Office for an inside look of how coordinated access brings together service providers, landlords, and funders to help people move from homelessness into permanent supportive housing as quickly as possible.
I think we use coordinated access and coordinated entry interchangeably here locally. I think just in the same way that you can say either coordinated access or coordinated entry, I think similarly we'll say a by name list or a prioritized list or a queue. They're interchangeable. The idea is that it's a process designed to ensure coordination of housing services and resources. So we want to move away from the old process of folks accessing housing services where people had to apply at multiple different agencies for multiple different projects, be on multiple wait lists out at one time, call back to see where they're at on the wait list, and if they missed a call, they missed their opportunity. So we want to move away from that. And also this idea of like being housing ready, that you have to work with an agency for a while before you get prioritized with housing with them. Now the intent is to have multiple doors where people can access resources and providers, so that if you're already accessing services with a provider, you can get connected to a standardized assessment tool and get prioritized for our community's resources of housing rather than just what that agency has access to. And it's a way to put more of the onus on providers and our systems to direct people to the resources they need rather than someone who's experiencing homelessness having to navigate a very complicated system all on their own. Also with standardized assessment tools, the intent is to have people tell their story just once instead of every time they're seeking services and housing. It looks different in every system. Like, for example, the family system, the main point of entry is through 211. If folks want a culture-specific assessment and are already connected with an agency, they can ask for one there. Generally, it's a lot of different folks. So we have outreach workers are trained to do the assessment. So if they are working with folks that are living outside, they're able to do assessments with them as they visit their encampments and the places that they're staying. We also have shelter workers trained to do the assessments. Some of our agencies have walk-in hours at their clinics. And so and people who are case managers are also trained so they can do the assessment with people that they're already working with. The idea is that, you know, wherever someone presents and when they are ready for an assessment, that we are able to connect them with someone who can do that. So sometimes it is the first time an outreach worker meets someone. Other times it's after doing some engagement with someone. Once an assessor inputs that information, then staff of the joint office can pull reports that has the answers to all that information. Then we can use that in what we call case conferencing, which is groups where all of our providers come together and talk about the people that are on the list and the housing openings and other resources our systems have. And then we have conversations about matching people. So someone's assessment and their score is really only one piece of how they get prioritized for housing. When people don't get prioritized, we often do see people get more vulnerable. They get sicker out on the street because we're not offering housing services. And that is another really unfortunate reality that I think a lot of work is being done to address that. I've heard providers say, if we're prioritizing the most vulnerable, the people who've been on the street the longest, we're not prioritizing the people who aren't at that stage yet. The people who are newly entering homelessness, they're just not getting the services they need. And then 2 years down the line, they will be the vulnerable people who have those 12 months plus of homelessness that now we're prioritizing. So there's a lot of work happening to also prevent people from getting to that point. One of the benefits of coordinated access is that our providers don't have to feel like they're doing this work on their own, that they can come to these system meetings. They can see our resources as community resources. You know, I've heard agencies that didn't have a lot of housing resources before say that it was really challenging to work with folks that were experiencing homelessness and not really have much housing to offer them. And with coordinated access, they can still provide some support services, but they might not be the agency that houses them, right? Like, they're going to get prioritized on the list, hopefully, and then matched to an agency that can house them. And if they still want to work with that previous agency, they can absolutely go still get services there. But that agency doesn't have to feel like they're all under one roof, have to provide every single thing for someone. On the flip side, some of our agencies are able to house someone, but maybe they don't specialize in mental health services, or they don't have culture-specific services in-house. And so they're able to make referrals outside of their agency to make sure that someone is able to get those services. And through coordinated access, that's one avenue for people, our providers, to be building those relationships. You don't just hear about someone who works at Urban League or know of this program with Central City Concern. You're actually like in meetings with those people, and you're able to have conversations with them. You're able to put faces to names. You are at these meetings, we're having people share about the new services they have or ongoing services they have. And so someone in that meeting can say like, oh, I'm working with someone who needs that. And actually at the end of the meeting, go and get their phone number and make those connections there. So I think it helps with making our, like I said, making our providers feel like they're not on their own and that we can work together to meet someone's needs, because assuming that one agency, one provider at an agency can do that isn't setting them up well.
Those coordinated access meetings with the providers, those were happening before the COVID pandemic?
Yes, they were. Yeah, a lot of them have switched to being virtual, but we have had those for years. You know, the youth system has been doing, they haven't called it coordinated access, it's the homeless youth continuum, but they've been doing coordinated access since the 90s. You know, the domestic violence system has also been doing this for a very long time. The family system's been coordinating their services since around, like, I think 2014. So a lot of our providers have been doing this work for a long time. The adult system is the newest of our coordinated access systems. We piloted with our federally funded, a few of our federally funded projects, Hope and Haven in 2016, and then we opened it up to the rest of our federally funded projects in 2017. And so since then, we've incorporated a lot of new projects. We've either gotten new projects from applying for federal resources, and then now a lot of our local projects are starting to go through coordinated access.
That was Katie Dineen from the Joint Office of Homeless Services. You've made it to the almost end of this inaugural podcast. Thank you for joining us on the inaugural episode of Out of the Streets of Portland, a podcast produced by the Joint Office of Homeless Services, a Multnomah County department with funding from the county, the city of Portland, Metro, and the state and federal governments to house, shelter, and provide street outreach, employment assistance, and case management to people experiencing homelessness in our community. Please subscribe to our podcast to get notified every time a new episode is posted. Our next episode will feature Dr. Marisa Zapata from the Homelessness Research and Action Collaborative at Portland State University, talking about the evidence-based method of housing first, which doesn't mean housing only, so definitely look out for that. And again, you can find this podcast along with a ton of information and reports at our website, multco.us/JOHS. Thanks again for listening to Out of the Streets of Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Atomic Bamboozle, the false promise of a nuclear renaissance, on Sunday, March 12th from 2:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. at Cinema 21 in Portland. Atomic Bamboozle is a documentary film that challenges the proposed climate change solution of returning to nuclear power. The film will be followed by a Q&A with experts and advocates in the film. Again, that's Atomic Bamboozle, the false promise of a nuclear renaissance, on Sunday, March 12th from 2:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 2 Special Programming Campaign. Check out all the great special programs we're bringing to you in February and March at kboo.fm/thrills. Help us reach our goal of $17,000 by March 25th. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text us. Type in KBOO to the number 44321. For the thrill of it all, keep listening.
Hi, this is Dwight Yoakam, and you're listening to KBOO.
Welcome to Out of the Streets of Portland, a podcast focused on sharing the stories of people who are currently or formerly houseless in our community and helping navigate the systems and services that the Joint Office of Homeless Services and its partners either have in place or continue to develop to help people move out of homelessness and back into stable, supportive housing. Today on Out of the Streets of Portland, we're going to hear about how our expanding and innovative shelter system works, how people can access shelter, and what it means to expand shelter alongside a housing first, but not housing only practice that centers the people's needs in the rehousing process. We'll speak with Gwen, who along with her partner Dan made it off the streets and into permanent housing after staying for 8 months at shelters run by Do Good Multnomah. But first, we're going to start this episode of the podcast with a segment called Busting a Myth. Today's myth is that housing first means housing only, which implies that people are left to wait on the streets for years while new affordable housing is being constructed. The reality is that thousands of people are rehoused every year, with some in newly constructed apartments, but many more in the apartments already available in our community. And for those who need ongoing support, we provide services alongside rent assistance. Some people are housed in weeks and months, not years. And busting a bonus myth, like every municipality and local government that follows the research-backed practice of housing first, Multnomah County and the Joint Office invest in both housing and shelter, not just one or the other. Since it launched in 2016, the Joint Office of Homeless Services has embarked on an historic expansion of shelter beds in Multnomah County. In 2020, when the COVID-19 global pandemic began, these efforts accelerated. At full capacity, the number of shelter beds supported through the Joint Office increased from 800 in 2016 to almost 2,000 as of January 2023, and hundreds more beds are on the way. We have shelters for adults, people and families, unaccompanied youth, and domestic violence survivors. Shelters are reservation-based, open 24/7, and welcome partners, pets, and personal belongings. They offer meals, and some have full kitchens. They also offer laundry access, showers, and case management and housing navigation services. You can find more information about our shelter system, including a map of locations, at multco.us/shelters. Over the past 2 years, 17 new shelters have opened with support from the Joint Office, including alternative village-style shelters, motel shelters, and traditional congregate shelters. So why have a both-and housing-first approach that provides shelters while also ensuring that people have options so they can move on from shelter or never have to come to one in the first place? Research conducted by Portland State's Homelessness Research and Action Collaborative found Housing First participants experience higher levels of housing retention and use fewer emergency and justice system resources than people in shelter-only communities. This produces cost savings for hospital emergency departments, a decrease in inpatient hospitalizations, and reduced dependence on the criminal justice system. The next segment in Out of the Streets of Portland is definitions. In this short section, we define a term that's used in navigating our neighbors through the homelessness and housing system. Today, we're going to define the word navigation itself. Sometimes you might hear people talking about navigation or navigation workers. This is simply another name for a specific type of outreach worker, someone who goes to camps, meets people where they are, and helps them navigate the services available to find the program that works best for them and their situation. In this episode of Out of the Streets of Portland, we'll start with the story of Gwen, who was living on the streets of Portland with a broken hip until a volunteer at a severe weather center helped her get on a waiting list for a year-round shelter. After 8 months in shelters, she and her boyfriend are now in an apartment of their own, and she's getting the medical care she needs. Then we'll hear about how people navigate into the shelter system and other services, including how to move from shelter into housing. We'll talk with staff from 211, which is the main hotline for people to call to find shelter and other services. We'll also talk with Joy Jones, the current head of Transition Projects, one of the longest-standing shelter and housing services providers in Multnomah County. Gwen lived with her boyfriend in their van for a year and a half before they moved into beds at the Arbor Lodge Shelter, run by Do Good Multnomah, opened in part with funding from the Metro Supportive Housing Services measure. They stayed there for 6 months until the shelter was closed for renovation. Along with other Arbor Lodge shelter residents at that time, they were moved to a motel shelter and then moved into an apartment with support from the joint office, also from the Metro measure. Gwen is overjoyed to be housed again. She and her boyfriend were promised work in Portland from a friend before moving here from Florida in 2020. During their drive to start working in Portland, Gwen suffered a debilitating hip infection that left her unable to walk. Here's Gwen telling her story from the kitchen of her new apartment.
I wasn't injured when we came here. We thought we were going to work when we came here. We have our friend that was coming here. He's lived here for 11 years, and he said, I'll give you guys a van. I'll have work for Daniel, and you can get a job. The jobs pay more, and, you know, we'll figure it out. 2 days in the trip is when I started not being able to walk, and I thought it was because we were in the car. It was a 5-day car ride, and little did I know, I was lucky I ended up coming here, because in Florida, there's no transportation like there is here, like public transportation, the health care, everything. I would have been in a really bad spot if I had been there and this had happened to me, like a really, really bad spot. 6 months prior to this happening, we were in an accident on a scooter in Florida, and they rear-ended us. I fell on my hip. They did x-rays and everything. Everything looked fine. So I thought it was just from that. You know, I had landed on it, but I guess the punctures had allowed bacteria to get into my hip. So I just seen the doctor on January 5th. They want to do like a 2-part surgery. I go to the infectious disease doctor tomorrow. And people see us out there and they like don't believe, you know, they don't believe that I'm injured because I'm young. And it's hard to sometimes understand that someone can be injured. They think, why don't you have a hip replacement right away? In my situation, they can't do it right away because if it gets reinfected, they'll take the hip out. And then I'll really be in a bad spot. Like, so they're talking about doing a 2-part hip surgery for me, where what they do for someone that does get a hip infection, they put a temporary hip in first with antibiotics attached to it. Put that in for 3 months, they take that out, then they put the normal one in. So I can't walk on my own. I can walk with the walker like short distances. If it's too long, then I have to go in the wheelchair, like if it's a long distance. Which is hard because for those wait lists too, if you don't have a phone, if you don't have an email that you can check, it's hard because when you're out there, it's hard to charge your phone. It's hard to find a place. Like if you don't have a car and our car outlet didn't work, it's hard to find somewhere to constantly charge your phone to be able to check your email. Even if you have a phone that does have it, you have to charge it. And people don't understand, like they think you want to just be homeless, but it ends up being like little tasks, taking a shower, everything. We would literally, when we would panhandle, we'd get money and go drive to Troutdale to the truck stop just to take a shower. And people are like, what are you out here? You need all this money. You guys are just drug addicts. And you're like, listen, I need to take a shower. I need to go get my mail. I need to go to my doctor's appointments. It's hard. You already feel hopeless, lost. You feel like nobody cares. And sometimes you just need somebody to guide you a little bit, and it means a lot. We had just done our food stamps and my insurance that day, and our phone wouldn't even charge in our van, nothing. And the lady happened to call us. It was just, sometimes it's just lucky, and they call so many people every day and they can't even get a hold of them. And these people probably would want shelter, but people's numbers change. You're out on the street, you don't have a phone, can't charge the phone. All of a sudden, we thought maybe the lady at the food stamps office had referred me to the shelter, because it just was so weird how all of a sudden Arbor Lodge called me that day, and she's like, oh no, you're on the waiting list. And we had completely forgotten about it. It was like 6 months later, and we went there, and you know, we stayed there ever since. And they're remodeling it now. It's
supposed to be really nice when it's done. Even that, I have to say, like, I was grateful just to have that, because at least you get a place to get out of your vehicle and stretch your legs, or from being off the street, you're safe, you have a building around you. They feed you 2 meals a day if you want it. You know, you can charge your phone, you can use Wi-Fi and watch TV. Like, it's, they let us, when we did the retmo class, they had one computer, like desktop, and then they have their like little tablet computers that they use. They let him use one, and I used the desktop to do our class. And like, you know, just to have even that, being from in a tent to there, you have shelter from when it was 100 degrees out, you can at least be inside. When it's pouring rain or cold, you're at least inside. You've got access to a shower. It may not be best, but it's better than having to go pay $14 or not taking a shower for a long time. And you have people there, like, just to have people to talk to guide you, you know, in the right direction, you know, just to get the kind of support you need. I was scared when we left there, you know, because you make bonds with people there too, you know, and then you have to see people come and go. But we've seen a lot I'll have to say that I've seen a lot of people get housed who do good, and that's what gave me hope. That's what made me never want to leave, never want to get written up. Like, we never missed a night there. We made it there every night. I never stayed out a single night. It's a low barrier shelter, so they really try to meet you where you're at. Like, they don't judge you. We literally went to them, like, asked them, what are the next steps, you know, like, what do we have to do to get housed? And they told us we had to do the coordinated care, the Vispidat, the assessment. I got out of the hospital, and like a week later, they did the assessment. And I scored high enough that they said that there was me and one other person there that would be going into permanent supportive housing. I don't know if it's rapid rehousing, because I was reading about that, where it's up to 2 years, and that seems like what we're in is rapid rehousing, where you get up to 2 years to get your, you know, your life together, which can make a big difference, you know, just having this time for me to have my surgeries, to, you know, for us to get our life together, for him to get a GED, to look for jobs. Like, you know, I'm hoping one day I can work again, you know, I can get my hip replaced and I can actually have a normal job and help people. I'd really want to help people like ourselves. Like, we do a lived experience group that we meet on the 2nd and 4th of the month, and anybody's welcome that has lived experience and or living experience, and we're just at the ground levels of starting and trying to get our mission statement. And I'll have to say, like, when we were at Arbor Lodge, I can count like at least 20 people that I personally have seen get housed there. I have to say, they get people housed. It may take longer than people want it to take. Realistically, yeah, it'd be great if we could be housed in 2 to 4 months, but you have to think about it, like, 3 months of us waiting wasn't even because of Duguid, it was because of the apartment wasn't ready. Everything is a process, and that's where people don't realize it takes time. It's been, you know, it's a challenge, but we've been very blessed, because people over at 82nd and Stark, like, we've met some of me, like, amazing strangers that they don't know us. They don't have to help us. You know, you've seen us out there. They don't even, like, they believe. And just having a stranger care that much about you to stop and help you and believe in you, it helps you to have the motivation to go forward, to keep going. It makes you, like, it's hard when you have no support system, nobody, and tend to give up. It's rough being homeless. It's not easy. People are like, you're a bum, you're lazy. Being homeless is farthest from being lazy. Like, you walk miles, you, like, everything you do takes time. It's just mentally, physically draining, spiritually draining. It's hard to come back from if you don't, you know, to get first, last, and security, or to even get someone to give you a chance, because, like I said, they stereotype you. It's a shame, because I've met a lot of people out there that, there's so many different people that I've met that are homeless. There's no one size fits all. Like, I've met people out there that are just old and get a social security check and they can't afford a place. And that's really sad. I've seen vets out there that, same thing, can't afford a place. it's sad because being not having a house doesn't define who you are. There's a lot of good people out there that I've met that just need a chance. Like, giving us a chance has changed my life completely. Sometimes you need someone just to give somebody a friendly hand and show them that there's a way. Sometimes goes a lot farther than being rude to somebody and not helping them at all. Like, you, people don't understand how far a kind gesture can go to helping a lot of people out there. Like, because a lot of people do, but they're so hopeless. It's hard to keep your mind right out there and to be positive, because it's a struggle. It really is, and it's very hard to get out of it. And just to have like this opportunity here, it makes you want to do good. And we know some other people that have been housed who do good, and they're the same way. They get a check and they're doing great because they, you know, they haven't had this in a long time. And the lady was saying here, like, we actually make better tenants a lot of time because we're so scared to lose it that we make sure everything is taken care of nice. We don't want any problems. We don't want conflict. I think shelters are great. I think that, you know, getting people the housing first approach is great. You need to get people into houses. There's a lot of funds out there with the measure that passed and everything that I think a lot of good can be done, but I think there's still a lot of work that needs to be done for the shelters. There's no, like, perfect way. This is a system that I hope one day it gets down where people can move through the system faster. But at the same time, I'm very grateful for that system being there because it's needed. It really is needed.
The Joint Office funds primarily low-barrier shelter opportunities that emphasize trauma-informed site design, meeting participant needs for privacy and community, and tailoring programs to the people they intend to serve. We center equity and the voices of shelter participants in the programs we design. And we work to reduce barriers to shelter, including using harm reduction practices and trauma-informed approaches to ensure people have the support they need to move from the streets into safety and stability. Kara Kangas works at 211 Info, which is a free phone number that anyone can call any time of the day or night to find out about services and get help and support.
211 Info is an independent nonprofit. We were established in 2004 to be the statewide service that provides 211 services to Oregon. And we also provide 211 services to four counties in Southwest Washington. What that looks like is for folks needing access to community resources, information, and referral, they can dial 211 from their telephone, or they can visit our website or download our mobile app, text us or email us for information about resources based on their zip code. We also have a number of specialty programs that focus on housing and shelter access, food access, childcare resources, COVID-19 information, vaccine information. We are available 24/7 by phone, by email, and text messages. It's Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. And since the start of the pandemic, when that began in February 2020, we were hovering around 60 employees. And now agency-wide, we're between 150 and 160 folks. And we also want to make sure that people are getting to the right place at the right time. So if someone needed to get, let's say, to a community meal today because they're experiencing food insecurity, we have the capability in our database to see which agencies are offering a community meal right now at this time, or maybe later today, or if they have a food pantry. So we also have, we call these match list notes, and you can see them on our website and on our mobile app as well, where it's notes that are in red that pop out that talk about hours of operation, specific eligibility criteria. So if someone needs to meet a certain age requirement, 18 or older, 55 or older, veteran status, whether or not a wait list is closed or not. And so what really drives a lot of that very specific information is contracts with the Joint Office and having that information just readily available to folks that need it. So when you first call 211, you will be prompted to enter a zip code. And if you're not sure where or what zip code you are currently in, that's okay. We can still chat with you and if you're in downtown Portland, if you're anywhere in Portland, we'll try to figure out what's the closest zip code so we can connect you to the closest resources that the person or you are seeking at the time that you call us. So let's say you call right now, it's about 9:37 on a Friday morning, and you're in need of shelter in Multnomah County. We'll take you through a series of screening questions. We might ask you if it's okay to ask some optional demographic questions, maybe to help narrow down resources. We'll ask age and gender identity, and then ask you about your homelessness status, veteran status, and then just anything else that may pertain to getting you connected to resources more quickly. So part of our training includes how to get through these crisis calls, what to do, how to triage, being able to let folks know this is our boundary, this is what we can do, that we are not mental health professionals or licensed clinical social workers, but we want to help get them to that place where they need to be and make sure it's a safe place, that they feel safe and comfortable with a warm transfer. And what's nice about having community is they are our boots on the ground staff who are connecting with homeless coalitions and service providers and school districts and libraries and medical systems. So they are the eyes and ears to what services exist. And what they do is help empower that cyclical relationship with the agencies that are listed in our database, helping them ensure that the information they provide is up to date and correct. If they need to suspend a listing in our database for any amount of time, maybe they're at capacity and they need to let us know, we can quickly input that information into the database so that way we're not misreferring anybody to a service that, you know, may go on pause for a moment. And they are literally every day pulling in new resource information, updated information put into our database and out in the community serving as many people as possible.
There's a group of people who have long histories of cycling through the mental health corrections and homeless services systems. By aligning those systems to identify and better serve those people, we save the community money and improve outcomes for those served. Housing specialists work one-on-one with shelter residents to identify and remove barriers, including getting new IDs, clearing old debts. We also work with landlords to request some flexibility and create positive rental relationships, including ongoing mediation or mitigation funding that supports a long-term housing situation. Housing specialists continue working with newly housed families to ensure long-term stability, including rent assistance, workforce assistance, and access to needed social services. Joy Jones is the head of Transition Projects. She talks about how their organization supports people in their journey from the streets to safety and stability.
We do shelter, so that's primarily what we are known for, that's individual partners and couples around the Portland area. We also do outreach and have outreach teams, so outreach to encampments and other communities where we try to bring people to services. We also do what I call scattered sites, so that's property management, landlord-based properties, where we place individuals or families in permanent housing, generally supported by some type of subsidy. And then a function within the organization is not only the staff who work in the shelters, but also our case managers that provide the something of coordinating services. We also, which is kind of unique to Transition Projects, is we manage and operate the resource center that is in Old Town. And that really is kind of walk-in, open service for those who need an array of services, including mostly centralized around housing. And then we have the opportunity to partner with other nonprofits who also come in and provide services, anything from like dental care, we do haircuts, shower, we manage mail. People don't realize how critical it is when you're unhoused and you don't have a place to send your mail to. We're gonna be doing some partnership with district attorney's office to address some legal concerns of those that we serve. And before the pandemic, we were providing other services by other service providers. I call them sister agencies. The organization was founded in 1969 by Reverend Gilbert Lule to address homeless services specifically for men. in this area. So that's interesting. In 1970, a consortium of 13 churches incorporated Burnside Projects. And previously, the agency has previously operated shelters for adult and youth, alcohol and drug outpatient programming, a day shelter, and an employment program. In our current form, we are operating again shelters, outreach programs, resource center, permanent supportive housing, and a scattered site model. And the other thing that I did not mention is that we also have alternative build that we did of Argyle Gardens, which is on Argyle Street. And so that has been a lovely venture of 72 units, about four buildings built in community. And that is offers some permanence, has permanency housing, and that opened just before the pandemic, but offers permanency, especially for those that we serve. We tend to serve people who are chronically unhoused, older, unhoused longer periods of time, lots more challenges than what you see for the other about 80% of people who are experiencing maybe couch surfed, you know, or living on the edge.
That was Joy Jones, the head of Transition Projects, the largest and one of the longest running homeless services providers in the Portland area. Thank you for joining us on this episode of Out of the Streets of Portland, a podcast produced by the Joint Office of Homeless Services, a Multnomah County department with funding from the county, the city of Portland, metro, and the state and federal governments to house, shelter, and provide street outreach, navigation, employment assistance, assistance obtaining Social Security income, and case management to people experiencing homelessness in our community. Please subscribe to our podcast to get notified every time a new episode is posted. Our next episode will feature Dr. Marisa Zapata from the Homelessness Research and Action Collaborative at Portland State University talking about the evidence-based method of housing first, which doesn't mean housing only. So definitely look out for that. And again, you can find this podcast along with a ton of information, data, and reports at our website, multco.us/JOHS. Thanks again for listening to Out of the Streets of Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.